The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Imagine your home totally organized with Closets by Design. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BY-DESIGN.
Ohtani just kind of snuck behind and just jumped through and just got him in the face, man. And it was evidently telling him nine more. You know, I wasn't close enough to hear it. I saw it. But yeah, Friedman later said, yeah, he was saying, you know, he was hoping to do this nine more times. And to me, that's just kind of the thing about him, right, is that he's mentally very different than most of the other players, right? That most of the players won't have the courage, so to speak, to have the ambition that he does, right? Okay. Because if you want to be the best of all time, that means everybody who tries that, except for one person, is going to fail, right? Only one person can be that. You're, by making goals like that, you're destined to fail.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and I'm thrilled. I really am. I'm thrilled today to be joined by noted St. Louis City fan, one of the guys who just, he's beloved here. He's beloved when he comes to town, the few times that he has. And, of course, it is St. Louis is the place where you like to eat the most, right, Dylan?
Of course.
Yeah, of course. It is, of course, Dylan Hernandez. Sports columnist at the Los Angeles Times. Dylan is a great friend, and it's a great treat to have you here. You're at Dodger Stadium now, and you are preparing to cover the parade?
Yeah, well, so they split this thing up in two parts. So there's going to be a parade through downtown, and then they're going to come to the stadium where they're going to have kind of like a rally slash celebration type thing. So obviously, you know, when the Dodgers won their last championship in 2020, during the pandemic, so they weren't able to do this. So this is really the first time the city's done this, since 1988. You know, the Rams had a parade, a few years back that nobody went to. Aaron Donald was sloshed there, you know. what I really liked about that one was, like, I mean, Aaron Donald was, like, blacked out drunk. And then McVay, you know, and at this point, right, we weren't sure if he was going to come back or not. And McVay jumps on the microphone and he tells Aaron, we're going to run it back, right? And Donald agreed to come back there. So maybe Andrew Friedman would be doing that to some of their impending free agents, like Oscar Hernandez.
Yeah, Oscar Hernandez, yeah. Well, all right, so you brought up the Rams. Let's get right to it. I mean, the Rams plucked out of St. Louis and taken back to Los Angeles. But, you know, are the Dodgers coming for the Cardinals National League crown? Is that what's happening here? Cardinals have 11 World Series titles. Dodgers now have 8 and don't show any signs of slowing.
I don't know if that's necessarily, you know, I know it seems like it just because they've won so many division titles, you know, and in like the last like decade and a half. But, you know, they are at this interesting juncture where I think, you know, when this new ownership group came in and took over the team in 2012, they talked about really kind of building a farm system, actually a lot like the Cardinals, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, develop their own players and basically kind of pick out free agents to kind of fill out the rest of the roster. And kind of what's happened, though, if you look at this time, they've really produced just two guys. It's been Walker Buehler and it's been Will Smith. And, you know, they've had some guys here and there that have helped, sure, and, you know, guys that have filled out rotations over the years, but, you know, over, like, the course of a season. But no, like, real, like, everyday type guys. I mean, you know, the Corey Seagers, Cody Bellingers, those are guys from the previous regime.
Yeah.
And now what you're having, you know, so basically it seems like they're relying more and more on these free agents, right? It's, you know, or guys that were about to become free agents that they traded for, like Mookie Betts. You know, they were able to get Freddie Freeman. Now it's Ohtani. You know, now it's Yamamoto. Now it's Glasnow. And I do wonder if at some point these contracts all kind of start to run into each other. You know, I know very kind of early in his tenure, Andrew Friedman talked about being smart about spreading these contracts out. So I do think that there is kind of this window here of sorts where, you know, Ohtani's 30 now. I think Betts is going to be 32-ish maybe, I think, soon. Freddie Freeman's already 35. So what happens when those guys kind of age out of their primes, right? I think, they're going to have some issues to address there. And there's a lot of money tied up in those guys. Now, I do think the kind of game changer was the fact that Ohtani basically just like, I mean, he's practically paying these guys to play for them at this point, you know.
It's crazy.
Yeah, and so that's what's allowed them to, you know, that, you know, really until this year, they didn't really go out and spend on pitching. You know, they went out and got Glass down Yamamoto. You know, you could question kind of the how wise those particular investments were, but they were able to kind of spend. And I do wonder kind of now that they've won and they've seen this huge uptick in advertising and stuff like that, you know, if that money could be reinvested back in the team. You know, I'm not 100% sure if that's the way it works because, you know, the way these teams are set up now, right, there are 20 shell companies within these things. And, you know, you can talk about all the parking revenue they make, whatever, but that goes into – that's like an entirely separate company, right? The TV is a separate – that goes into a separate pool. So who knows, you know, what's going on with that. But, yeah, but they could – you know, my point is, I guess, there is a possibility that they can kind of – end up at this point where they're going to have a bunch of kind of expiring contracts all kind of running into each other, where they could be financially hamstrung about 5 years down the road from now.
While the Cardinals didn't have the success of the Dodgers in winning the World Series or here recently even getting to the postseason, one of the like problems that they've diagnosed here and has like kind of led to the trim down that they're going to do, the kind of move towards youth, is the fact that they didn't have that homegrown tentpole player. You know, the Yankees do with Aaron Judge. I find it interesting that you talk about, like, the Dodgers. They've kind of just outfitted a nucleus of players from their farm system, but the big tentpoles are from outside. They traded players to get them, or they signed them. The Cardinals feel like their way to success, because otherwise you just fall into a pit of spend, like the money pit approach. Their best bet is to grow that homegrown player. Can the Dodgers, because their profits are going to be so enormous and their player improvement machine, if you will, is so strong, can they do what other teams cannot? Can they do the money pit approach?
I mean, that's kind of what they have been doing, right? I mean, as much as I think people like to, you know, talk about the Dodgers farm system, right? They're always ranked very high by like Baseball America and stuff.
Yeah, but you know, top five again. Yeah.
Right. But those things are also kind of like political, you know, those things are also about like depth, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, because, you know, when you have a guy like, you know, right. The mm-hmm. last guy that was like that Uber, you know, generational prospect was Corey Seager. And we knew it from the time he was like in rookie ball. Right. Same thing with like Clayton Kershaw was probably the guy before that. It's like, OK, this guy's coming. He's going to change everything. Like you just kind of know it. And they really haven't had that kind of guy, you know. And yeah, so far, you know, as much as look, their farm system has been very good in terms of just kind of filling out the roster. Right. And like I always say, you know, a lot of their regular season success has to do with the fact that they have had a lot of starting pitchers over the years. And they, you know, they produce these guys who can beat the Rockies on a Tuesday.
Right.
But going out and winning a World Series, that's like a whole different level of like player, right? That you need, the type of pitcher that you need. And they haven't been able to kind of develop that guy. And so, you know, really the strength here, you know, it says, I mean, you know, I don't want to take anything away from the front office, but they do have more money than everybody else. Like, let's not kid ourselves about what
they do. Yeah. They have just
outspent everybody. Right. And, you know, and I think, again, like with this Ohtani thing, and again, the fact that he was willing to defer as much money as he did, mm-hmm. You know, because people are saying, right, I mean, all this, so $68 million a year that they're deferring, right? And this stuff doesn't have to go into like an escrow account necessarily, right? You can take that money and invest it, whatever. Obviously, Guggenheim is an investment company. They can, you know, there have been some estimates that the $680 million you know, that they'll be deferring could be turned into more, that they could double that money over the lifetime of that contract.
Right.
And so that's now money that can go and reinvest. So, yeah, I'm not, obviously they have not opened their books to me. Right. Obviously they don't even have to open their books to the U.S. government. So, you know, the fact, I'm not too familiar with the insides of their finances, but yeah, you do get the feel that maybe this is kind of the model now, that they're just going to keep outspending, you know, and they'll look, and here's the thing too, though, is that they're, you know, Ohtani's going to be kind of that tentpole for the next decade, right?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, everything is going to kind of be built around that. And, you know, the one thing about them is that they do try to, and I think that this, you know, over the years, I think this has been a problem, frankly, that, you know, they need to win every deal. They insist on winning every deal. They want to get the better of every trade, and every free agent that they sign, they want to get it on their terms, right? They don't ever, rarely have they overpaid for guys. And, you know, I think that sometimes that makes them right? Instead of them dictating the market, they let the market dictate to them what they can and can't do. And so some years, right, the last couple of years, we saw this, right? They go into the playoffs and they don't have starting pitching, right?
Right.
And frankly, they were in danger of that this year even, you know? But I do think that because of kind of that approach, like, they're not going to do anything too crazy. You know, like, my guess is, you know, if Roki Sasaki gets made available, you know, the 22-year-old Japanese kid who throws 100, they're going to be in on that, right? Because that kid is basically for free, right? He's going to come here.
Right.
He's an international amateur. So when he signs, he's there to a minor league contract. You're paying this guy nothing.
Just and as Ohtani arrived. Same
correct,
thing.
Yeah. And they're going to try to look to kind of fill out, I'm guessing, their team with, you know, guys like that, right? If they bring back Teoscar Hernandez, I'm guessing he's going to come back on a very team favorable type deal. I mean, you know, Hernandez, right, has made it very clear that he wants to be a Dodger, you know. And so they're going to use that to their advantage. You know, again, Walker Buehler is probably the same deal, that if he comes back, it's going to kind of come back on very favorable terms. So, you know, there is a kind of way to make this happen, I think.
I mean, you have LeBron James there with the Lakers, and everybody knows what LeBron James did with other guys with the Miami Heat or even there with the Lakers. I mean, is that where the Dodgers are headed somewhat, that they can be a place where stars want to go? They might take less to stay or to go there once, even if it's for a brief chance, because that's the place to be, both for the market, for the ballpark, for the attention, for the chance to win a championship. I mean, have they kind of become that place?
Yeah, I think so. You know, and I guess it's going to depend on each individual guy, right? I mean, the question that I have, say, let's take the Roki Sasaki example, right? He's obviously not quite there yet, but he does project to kind of be a superstar. You know, are you happy kind of, you know, just being like another guy on a team? Because that's what will happen if he comes to this team, right? You know, if Sasaki comes, it's going to be Ohtani, it's going to be Betts, it's going to be Freeman, and then he's going to fit in somewhere after that. You know, or does he, you know, it seems like, right, because he was also kind of, after Ohtani, who's the kind of the generational talent Japan produced. I wouldn't be shocked either, though, that if, you know, just the way he's kind of carried his career over there, if he says, you know what, I don't want to be Ohtani's sidekick. I want to be, you know, I want to be the best.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So let me go to another team and let me challenge him. So I think that there will be, yeah. So I think that, you know, I think it's going to kind of depend player to player. You know, some guys obviously are going to like, hey, like, you know what, I haven't won, or, you know, I don't want all the attention on me, you know, because here there will be, you know, because Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman, I do think one of the big things that they've done, you know, Freddie's obviously always been really good with the media.
Yeah.
You know, Betts, I think, was always kind of a reluctant speaker. But what we saw really
now, he's a podcast host.
He's a podcast host. And I think, you know, he's really kind of taken it upon himself to be that guy who will kind of shoulder the blame when things are going bad. I really kind of respect it over the course of the year, you know, and even after, I think, the first couple of games in the playoffs, right? I think he went hitless the first two games. And I was all over him. Hey, you didn't hit the previous two post seasons. What's going on? And keep in mind, like, he got robbed of a home run there in left field.
Yeah.
You know, by Profar in game two. But he didn't make an excuse.
Dramatically. Like, yeah. Perfect played to the crowd, robbed.
Right. But he didn't complain about any of that, right? He was like, I haven't hit. It doesn't matter. And so he's learned to kind of take that responsibility. You know, it's like, okay, well, you know, if I answer these questions, my teammates won't have to. He understands that now, you know. And so I do think it is a very, you know, hospitable environment for a player who, you know, kind of maybe doesn't want to deal with certain things, that just wants to win. Yeah, sure, this is a great place to come if you're willing maybe to give up some money.
Did a couple former Cardinals find a home there then too? And Tommy Edman is signed through next year. And Jack Flaherty is obviously from there. They had really important roles in this October run. Have they kind of found maybe a long-term place there?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because with Flaherty, I think it's a little bit more up in the air because of how many just pitchers they have coming back next year. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you could argue, well, they're all like injury prone or are injured, you know, the Dodgers, right? And the Dodgers could be you know, in danger of entering next October the way they did this October, where you're looking at their rotation, you're like, okay, what do they actually have here? Now, you know, this year it turned out that all those guys kind of outperformed expectations, at least mine. You know, I'll very openly admit, I did not think they had the starting pitching to win a World Series, you know, but they're going to have a ton of guys coming back. So it's, you know, my guess is that what they'll offer Flaherty would be like somewhat limited, maybe, right? I'm guessing there'll be better offers elsewhere. Now, maybe he fell in love, you know, playing in his hometown, right? The fact that he can hug his mom after a game, maybe that'll convince him to take a little less. Edmund for sure is the type of guy that they love, right? Because he's got the versatility. You know, he kind of hits when it matters. And I will say this, you know, as much as I kind of, you know, I'm one of those guys that kind of rolls their eyes when they hear about the Cardinal way, you know.
Yeah. But like, yes, you are.
But Edmund really is that guy, right? You know, he's a tough at bat. You know, he does like the fundamental stuff really well. And I do think, you know, you watch this World Series, that was kind of like a big difference between the two teams, right?
Really?
The Dodgers and the Yankees. Yeah, I mean, the Yankees were sloppy, man. You know,
they're poor defensively. I wondered if that's the worst defensive American League champ we've ever seen.
Yeah, it was, you know, and even I think in the, you know, the previous two series before that, you know, against the Mets, against the Padres, you know, if you look at like the Dodgers team defensively, right, it's not, you know, outside of like Mookie Betts, you're not really looking at anybody that's like spectacular, you know. That said, they're not the team that's going to beat themselves anymore, right? Like maybe like they did in the past. You know, I go back, I remember, you know, Corey Seager, now he was a rookie, whatever, but forgetting to cover third base, right, like a shift or something, right? The things like that, those little things have come back to bite them. And the one thing now is they're, you know, they've really kind of, I think over the course of this past year, really kind of ironed out all that stuff. And there's real attention to detail. And I do think you can kind of credit, you know, Edmund was a part of that, right? And he brought over whatever he learned in the St. Louis organization. And I think it helped. I do think that the failures of the last 2 years obviously have contributed a lot to that from the Dodgers standpoint. They realized, okay, what we're doing here isn't working. We got to come in with heightened focus. But every time you add a different guy that already has that kind of mentality, I think it enhances that even more. And right now, I think that, you know, from like a mental, psychological standpoint, a very formidable team, right? Because, again, even in that clinching game and game five against the Yankees,
yeah,
you know, they're down five runs, and you give them a little bit of an opening, they're going to come through that now, right? And to me, more than even just like the talent that they have, that mentality to me is what's scary, right? That's what's going to keep them in every ball game, I think, you know, kind of in the relatively near future here until the roster really starts to turn over again.
Yeah, during that time when the Dodgers kept beating their heads against the Cardinals and not finding a way to get past them, when the Cardinals had those runs of NLCS appearances, it was that exact thing that you heard over and over again. The Cardinals had that big comeback against the Washington Nationals to even get to the NLCS against the Giants. So it's that same kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And it also becomes like momentum, right? Like
right.
Once you know you can do it, then it's familiar when it happens again the next year.
Right, and you can see it happening in advance, right?
But right.
As soon as it starts, you start to kind of feel it like, okay, here they come, you know, because, again, and I'm saying this as somebody who was viewing these Dodger-Cardinal series, right, from the Dodger standpoint, every time I see Matt Carpenter foul off like four pitches, you're thinking, okay, here it comes,
right?
You know, and I think, you know, again, you know, you mentioned Tommy Edman, right? You know, when he drew that, he drew a walk there, you know, in the eighth inning where the Dodgers wound up coming back in game five, and you kind of started feeling, okay, they got two guys on base now, you know, here it comes.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even like when Volpe makes that throw to third and there's not an out, then you kind of get that sense like, all right, this is going to happen now.
Because
it came back around, it was going to find Freeman, all that stuff.
Right. Right. You know, and again, it's just, you know, and they do have, you know, high end talent. Like, let's not pretend that they don't, you know, and that does, you know, again, when they're down five, right, and you have Ohtani coming up and you have Betts coming up and you have Freeman coming up, and as soon as they kind of start getting it going, all of a sudden that belief, like, it picks up very quickly. You notice it very fast, you know. And I you know, my favorite part of that eighth inning was, you know, when Edmund walks, so at that point there are two guys on base, Will Smith is now up at the plate, Ohtani jumps into the on deck circle. It was actually Gavin Lux that should have been there, right?
Right, right.
Ohtani
right.
skipped in line because he's like, I want to be there, you know, and there was this feeling of like, okay, here it goes, and everybody could kind of feel it.
That's pretty good. Well, all right, so what was the perspective at the time of the Tommy Edman trade? There's a three-team deal. The Cardinals were trying to get Eric Fetty from the White Sox. They had no interest in dealing Edmund to the Dodgers. The Dodgers had interest in Edmund, but the Cardinals didn't want to do that unless they were able, because they didn't see a match with the Dodgers, but they also saw what inevitably happened, yet another former Cardinal going off to win a championship series MVP. And they want to get Fetty if possible. Then sort of towards the end, they were like, wait a minute, if this deal, this is all from the Cardinals' perspective, wait, if this is going to, if they're going to flip Edmund, then maybe we can get more from it. And they got Tommy Pham, which is what they wanted to do. From the Dodgers' perspective, from L.A., how did that deal play? Because it was about Kopech, right?
Right, mostly. Right. Well, no, but they liked Edmund, too, you know.
Okay.
Now that said, from, like, my perspective, I was like, why are they trading for a guy who hasn't even played this year, right?
Right.
It felt very, again, it felt very Dodgers-like in the sense that it was controlled, right? They, you know, I do think the decision to part with Edmund was a lot of it from the Cardinals' standpoint, a business decision, right? They're trying to, right, yeah. He's going to become more expensive now, and so they're looking to get rid of him. And, you know, everything they kind of did at the deadline, right? Flaherty was a guy that, you know, that they were just, right, that was just being sold off too. From, you know, whenever a team's selling off guys for parts, that's when, like, the Dodgers come in, because there's a good deal to be had there. Again, they're not going to overpay for anybody, you know? And so, in a way, it was a little bit, like, underwhelming, right? You know, I know, right, because I think from the Dodgers' standpoint, you know, you're kind of looking at it from, like, a macro standpoint, right? The, you know, you're thinking, you know, this is a team that, you know, at one point traded for, you know, you and I remember this because we're old now, but, you know, they traded for Manny Ramirez at the deadline, right?
Right,
they traded for, you know, Yu Darvish at the deadline. They got Manny Machado at the deadline. So, like, I think, you know, at least the expectation of the city was like, okay, well, go out and get Scooble, right? You know,
right.
Now, you know, the Dodgers will tell you, well, look, they weren't even listening, right? The Tigers just kind of shut that down immediately. But hey, look, let's be honest, right? If you say, hey, you know what, we'll give you our top 20 prospects, just to play this out to, like, an extreme example.
Right.
Everybody is on sale, right? Everybody's available.
Absolutely.
Every single player in baseball that does not have a no trade clause is available, you know? And so I do think, like, kind of, it felt a little bit kind of underwhelming, right? And I think, you know, now that said, I think they very quickly fell in love with Flaherty. I'm sorry, the fans are starting to kind of
flood
into the stadium here. So
No. Are these Dodger fans or Dylan Hernandez fans? Which ones are flooding into the stadium right now?
Yeah, I don't think those fan groups overlap very much. But, yeah, you know, I think, you know, it kind of started with Flaherty, and that the team fell in love with him and his attitude very quickly.
Yeah.
And then when Edmund started to kind of play, and they kind of started to see, like, okay, you know, and look, and I also want to, I think what has to be kind of pointed out here is just kind of Mookie Betts' role in this whole thing, in terms of, you know, he could have made a mess of this situation, right? In terms of, you know, he likes hitting leadoff, right? And in the past,
Great point. They,
you know, at some point, you know, I think very early on, you know, when they first got him, I think they tried to put him at second at some point. He fought to move back into the leadoff spot. So he gets hurt. They put Ohtani there. Now he's out of his preferred position in the lineup. Doesn't say anything, right? It's like, well, it's Ohtani. Now, you know, he's been playing shortstop all year because, you know, frankly, Gavin Lux, whom they projected to be their starting shortstop, just couldn't make throws out there. You know, Betts takes it on himself. Hey, you know what? I'll play shortstop then. Struggles, but he's out there every single day taking grounders when he comes off injury. And the team, look, the team was nervous about this, right? They waited to approach him. They publicly were saying, no, when he comes back, he's going to be our shortstop, because they knew this was a sensitive thing. They talked to him about it. He agrees to move back, you know, to right field. And that, you know, so many superstars, right, especially like in this sport, you know, you can kind of dictate your terms. And I'm sure if Mookie had said, you know what, I'm not leaving short, my guess is he's still playing shortstop. Like, what are you going to do about that, you know?
Wow.
And, you know, so Betts kind of agreeing to kind of move back to right field, I do think kind of opened the door for, like, Edmund to kind of be the guy that he was. Now, I also think that partially part of the reason they got Edmund was to kind of put pressure on Betts maybe too, right? Well, look at our roster right now. This is a smart thing for you to do.
Yeah, you got a gold glove winner. This guy can play it. He's familiar with it. Yeah.
But it goes both ways, right? And I do think Mookie kind of opening that door for Edmund allowed Edmund to kind of come out and, you know, become the guy that he is here. And this is the kind of guy that I could kind of see hanging around you know, an organization for like a while, right? I mean, frankly, yeah. You know, he very well could have, right, in a different world and right where the Cardinals maybe are having success right now. He seems like the kind of guy that hangs around for an organization for like 10 years and, you know, becomes a fan favorite in the city. And right, even though he might not be known nationally or everybody in town likes him, and, you know, he's everybody's maybe second favorite player after the yeah. star, right? He could be one of those guys. Yeah, so I could definitely see that happening for him here.
I mean, Tommy Edman is the milk growth chart guy. I mean, that's the giveaway. You know, you're going to get a Tommy Edman glove. You're going to get a Tommy Edman milk chart, you know, growth chart. This is the thing. And kids will have a Tommy Edman item of some type because it would be popular with the kind of the giveaways and stuff, right? And everybody knows him. And he's earned it. He'll deserve it, too. NLCS, MVP, all of that. You know, we've talked about the trades. We've talked about the names. We've talked about the $700 million man, the $300 million man. I think Freddie Freeman, the World Series MVP, who just had a remarkable October. You know, he's a $160 million man, I believe. We've talked about all that spending. One of the things here with the Cardinals is how far they've fallen behind, you know, behind the scenes in the minor league system. Just the sheer number of coaches. And over the past few years, to me, it was always compared to, like, count up how many coaches – and how much support staff the Dodgers have, even in their big league dugout, but definitely in the minors, compared to the Cardinals and other teams. Dylan, what can you tell us about beyond the names, beyond the spending, like behind the scenes, what the machine is when it comes to player support and player development that the Dodgers have?
Yeah, you know, and they have a research and development team of, like, I don't know, like 50 guys. You know, just crunching numbers in the back there. They're behind, you know, they're using now that old visiting clubhouse there, you know, between the two clubhouses now. You know, and it's not just that the fact that they have a lot of staff, mm-hmm. it's that they were early on it too. You know, I remember just, I think it was last year, maybe just last year, the year before, you know, one executive of another team was kind of bragging that they finally had installed this like Hawkeye system, right? Mm-hmm. That yeah. tracks kind of all the biomechanics and stuff. And right, if your shoulder is opening up, you know, half
Holy
a second
cow.
Early, right, it's going to catch that. The Dodgers have pretty much had that from day one, right? As soon as Friedman came in, all that stuff got installed. So it's not just, I think, the size of it. It's the fact that they're so kind of far out in front, right, with so much of this tech. They're getting guys, you know, that are really good. You know, Connor McGinnis has been really you know, one of their pitching coaches, one of these specialists that kind of taking data and applying that like in baseball terms, you know, because I think that that's really kind of the culture here, right? Is, you know, like anywhere else. Look, when Friedman first came in, the first few years, there was definite skepticism on the part of the players about all the analytics and stuff. You know, there are some guys, you know, where they would come in with all this data and, you know, they felt like, why, who's this guy to teach me how to hit, you know? And now what they have, though, is like a group of baseball people that seems to be able to kind of translate that data into kind of baseball lingo, right?
Okay.
And when you talk about staff, I think that's really what you're kind of talking about. They have a lot of roving guys in the minor leagues, right? Again, like, yeah, I think you're right. Like, they probably have, my guess is, one of the bigger minor league coaching staffs, right, in baseball. And But it's not just that they have numbers there. It's that they have guys that can kind of translate one language into another and really kind of bridge those two gaps, you know. And I think it leads to, you know, kind of what you have now when you look at, like, the way they're pitching, right?
The
way the Dodgers bullpen was. Because, you know, again, from the time Friedman came in, I think he wanted to kind of go matchup, right? Now, that said, that's kind of hard to do when, you know, you have Clayton Kershaw on your starting staff and he's used to doing things one way. And obviously he's also, like, really good. Like, you don't want to prematurely take him out of the game, obviously. But now they're
and yet we see that with some teams. But go ahead.
But now they're starting to teach these guys from, like, the minor leagues, right? That mm-hmm. this is kind of the way, you know, you do things, right? And it's really allowed them to kind of simplify, I think, their pitching process, where now every time the middle of the order came up, you knew that they were going to use one of their high, right? It was going to be Trinan. It was going to be Hudson. It was going to be Kopech, right? They brought in Kopech, I think, the second or third inning of, like, one of these playoff games, right? Because that's what you do. You take your best guys and you have them hit their best guys. And, you know, now I think the downside of that, frankly, is, you know,
Yeah, look, and I used to argue with Andrew and with Farhan about this when Farhan was here, you know, when you had a camera like Julio Rios, right? Well, how's he supposed to become Clayton Kershaw if you never let him pitch through a lineup for the third time, right?
Right.
And so, you know, you maybe kind of lose that a little bit, but the game is kind of changing now, right? And, you know, especially now with kind of this premium on velocity, you know, and so the fact that, like, now you, again, from the time they come in, they're kind of being educated in this way. They're being kind of, you know, if you want to use a more negative term, like indoctrinated or whatever, you know, but they accept it, right? Whereas I do think, you know, if you had gone back even, you know, 5-10 years, there's probably you would have faced a little more resistance if you wanted to play baseball the way the Dodgers do right now.
Do you think that enhances talent? Do you think, I mean, obviously they, like we both said, they've spent a lot on obvious talent. I mean, it doesn't take a scout to know Freddie Freeman is good or that Mookie Betts is one of the best of all time or Shohei Ohtani. But do you think in some ways they create depth of talent for their roster because they're able to enhance talent through this infrastructure?
Yeah. Now, I do think the talent, I do think now it's much more specialized, right? I don't know. Again, right? I don't think, you know, the way they're kind of structured right now, if we're going to see another Clayton Kershaw, I mean, Clayton Kershaw's either anyway, but
right.
I'm not really sure you're going to kind of get that type of guy anymore, right? Because now they're being, again, the premium, again, is on velocity. Throw as hard as you can for as long as you can, and we'll kind of figure out the rest of it, you know? And now, again, right, even, you know, the lefty-righty splits, specializing stuff from the at-bat standpoint, you know, I think, and so in that way, they create these like specialists that can kind of fill in these holes, right? And frankly, here's the other thing too, right? Is that I'm not sure they're necessarily like drafting high enough to kind of get that kind of transcendent talent anyway, right? I mean, usually these guys, when you see, you know, you talk about these tentpole players, they come out of teams that are like drafting really high, right?
Bobby Witt Jr.
Yeah, Bobby Witt Jr., you know, Buster Posey with like the Giants, right? It's like, you know, I know Giants fans are kind of complaining, like, well, where is that guy? It's like, well, yeah, during that time, right, that team was picking high for a while, you know?
Right.
So the Dodgers are kind of now kind of in the back of that first round. And I do think what they're really good at doing, right? And now, from the pitching standpoint, this has been both good and bad in terms of it seems like the Dodgers are really good at taking that guy drafted between the fifth round and the 15th round and teaching him how to throw 98 miles an hour. Now, what I do wonder, though, is does that process break them, right? Because what we have seen is a number of, like, pitching injuries, you know, River Ryan, Gavin Stone, you know, Dustin May, you know, Tony Gonsolin, right, who wasn't even a pitcher in college. They've taken these guys and they've turned them into, like, real pitchers. Now, the problem is I think that process, whatever it is that they're kind of putting him through, you know, all that driveline stuff and, not sure how familiar you are with kind of the controversy over like the heavy ball stuff, right?
Yep.
And what it actually does to like ligaments. But it gets them there and it makes them contributors. It just kind of makes it hard to, you know, count on them long term.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, if you're drafting 1-1 and you get Paul Skeens, right, for whom 100, like you don't have to teach him how to throw 100, he just throws 100.
Right.
An easy 100. Now that guy can be an ace, but they're just not in a position to get that guy. So maybe, you know, maybe they're doing the best with what they actually kind of have.
Yeah.
At that point, but it is filling out their roster for sure.
I have watched firsthand as a team that had contended and won has been completely undermined by a pitching sinkhole that they did not prepare for, and then all of a sudden couldn't produce the talent from the minor league system to help even get them through. The Cardinals went through that, and they kind of survived by trading for Jose Quintana and John Lester and Jay Happ and all this stuff year after year. But eventually it just caught up with them and ended up with a losing season. It sounds like you're saying that might be beneath the foundation, the sinkhole that the Dodgers have to at least address.
Right. Well, you know, and again, what they do have is like money right now.
Right.
I do think, you know, like watching this World Series, to me it was just kind of weird, like looking at both teams and like, man, both teams, like, right, the kind of the lack of starting pitching depth, right? And, like, you know, and if you look at it, like, either team could have had Blake Snell, right?
Right.
If they were, like, he was just sitting there.
Right.
You know, now I do think the Dodgers have, like, a Borisitis. You know, they're afraid of Scott Boris, I think.
Okay.
They don't like negotiating with them just because, I don't know, like there's like a certain vanity I think that the Dodgers front office has, right?
And again, that's a Stan Kasten, right? That's Stan Kasten and
Scott.
That's
the Stan Kasten thing, yeah. And I think they don't want to, like, you know, because every now and then Forrest will stick you with an Anthony Rendon.
Yeah, right. Right.
You know, like a lot of it's a weird thing because sometimes a lot of times I do think you need his guys to win.
Right.
But also if you go to that well too much, like he's going to embarrass you at one point.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of a aversion to that. But yeah, to me it was kind of weird that, right, you had Snell out there. He could have been on either team, and it's like, what, you know, these teams have done such a great job, I do think, of brainwashing their fans, right, into thinking like it's smart or that it's cool to not spend on pitching. And again, like, and I get it, right? Pitching, you know, Mark Walter famously said very early on, you know, pitchers break, right?
Right.
And there is kind of this thing of like, okay, well, if you invest in a pitcher and he does break, that could be a problem, right? It could create a financial albatross that you just can't get rid of. At the same time, I've always kind of thought, if you don't take that chance, you're not, it's going to be really hard to win, you know? And even this year, right, whatever it is, you know, the Dodgers did spend $325 million on Yamamoto, right, who did wind up in the end being a very key part of, right? They don't spend that money on Yamamoto. They don't win this World Series.
Right, right? Exactly. And, yeah.
And they're basically paying that for five innings, you know. But I do think you need to pay that, though, right? And so it's kind of this weird balance. For sure, like, I think the depth guys, you know, I think that's the minimum that a fan base can demand of their team is get, you know, fill out 2 through 5 in the rotation, right?
Right.
The 1 and the 2... Now, I think the burden there is, okay, if you can develop him, great. But if not, I think there's an onus on the team to go out and get that guy.
Okay.
Because, look, these teams are making so much money. They really are, right? And you know, and they can say, like, well, you know what, like, you know, we're not seeing that, like, in revenue right away. But, yeah, but when you sell the team, right, for years, the business of baseball was you buy the team at one price, you hold on to it for, like, a decade, the price will, you know, grow exponentially, and then when you sell that's your profit, you know, because that money, whatever, you know, if the Dodgers get sold at some point, if the Cardinals get sold at some point, whatever profits the owners make off that sale, the team's not going to see that, the fans won't see that, you know, and so I feel that, like, there's an onus again on the teams to go out and spend that money, you know, make their product something worthy for the fans to follow, especially, like, in a, you know, not to get all preachy here on the Cardinals here, but, like, especially in a city like St. Louis, right?
Yeah.
The, what they mean to that city, because this is a business that's, like, unlike any other business, right? This isn't, you know, they're not selling you, you know, coffee or anything. They're selling you kind of like a feeling. And that feeling is linked to the fact that they're tied to your city, you know? And I've been to, look, my brother went to medical school in St. Louis. I've been to Cardinals games as fans. I've, you know, walked from the train station, you know, to the ballpark and back, right? I've come out of the ballpark absolutely just hammered out of my mind with a bunch of other people hammered out of their mind. I know that feeling that the people of St. Louis have, and I just feel, again, that it's not the worst thing for the team to kind of go out as a sign of good faith. Like, hey, you know what? We appreciate your business. We appreciate your loyalty, even when things are kind of tough here. And we're going to show it by going out and kind of making this, like, investment, right? And a lot of times, those types of deals set a foundation for something, right? I mean, I think back to that Jason Worth contract.
They can be force multipliers. They can be force multipliers, yeah.
Well, remember that Jason Worth contract with the Nats?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That contract in it, like, strictly from a baseball term, that contract was terrible, right?
Well, yeah.
Like, right? Like, yeah. Jason Worth got, what was it, like 120? It was the Barry Zito number.
No, it's even better. It was the Matt Holliday deal from the Cardinals.
Oh, that's
plus
right.
A bit. Yeah. And the Cardinals signed Matt Holliday. They traded for him, then signed him as a free agent. The biggest deal of the contracts the Cardinals had at that point in time. And then Jason Worth, also represented by Scott Boras, was going to beat Matt Holliday's number, even though, like, he didn't have anywhere near the career that Matt Holliday did. Yeah.
Yeah, but those things kind of – that's a statement, right? It's a statement of intention.
Absolutely.
You're signaling to your fans, we're trying to build something, you know? And then from there, again, you draft well, you develop well, and next thing you know, the Nats were World Series champions.
That's right. Yeah, they had to get past the Cardinals to do it, you know, but they worked them. That 2019, the last time Cardinals were in the NLCS, and they did not they were suffocated offensively in that deal. But for there for a long time, the Nationals had Jason Worth's walk-off home run from a playoff game in a series that they did not win as a like a prominent spot in their ballpark. I was like, what is going on here? But you're right. You're right about that. I got the chance to go to the Yamamoto start game two. I snuck out there, took my son who's out in college out there to that game. And it's, I mean, look, Dodger Stadium and everything that's going on there, the vibe is amazing. Yamamoto pitched so well that game. He really was impressive. What's next for the Dodgers? They seem, you know, from the outside, and we've kind of talked through it, they seem to have an endless supply of innovation, ingenuity, and finances to pull stuff off here. And they're only going to be more profitable because of Shohei Ohtani taking them to the globe and so much money that can be generated there. Not to mention all these other teams are convulsing with their regional sports networks. The Dodgers are not. They're bigger. They're better than that because they were ahead of the curve there, too. They're helped by the size of their market. They're helped by a lot of geography. What's next for them? I mean, is Juan Soto going to be in their outfield? Is Corbin Burns going to be in their rotation? What's next for them?
I think they're going to go back to kind of being relatively conservative. You know, I do think they'll like kind of play around with the Soto thing. I'm not buying it just because, right, from what I hear, kind of defensively, his feet are just terrible. And
yeah.
He's not a good outfielder. At some point, right, in a few years, say he has to move off the outfield. It doesn't sound like he can play first base because maybe you could kind of time him move to first
with
base
Freeman,
Freeman departing. But I'm told they don't even think, right, people around the game, I haven't talked to the Dodgers about this, but people around the game don't seem to think Soto can play first base, in which case that's going to leave you with two DHs, with Ohtani being the other. So I think Teoscar is probably more likely because Teoscar is kind of, right, giving up his leverage by saying how much he wants to come here. I could see him taking an undermarket deal to stay behind. You know, and then I think with, you know, I still think their starting pitching is a problem. You know, but that said, they're going to have Ohtani coming back, right? He theoretically will be pitching next year. And then I think they try to go after Roki Sasaki, who, again, will be free pretty much.
Yeah.
And that'll probably be more or less their out, you know, their offseason. I think they'll fill in some gaps here and there. But I'm not so sure that they're going to do anything like big, you know. I think they'll kind of go back to doing what they do in that, you know, because I think, again, their philosophy is as long as we don't overcommit in the wrong areas, we won't at least, like, take ourselves out of contention, right? And again, especially with all the big contracts kind of starting to pile up now, I think that they probably want to create some breathing room between, you know, the Ohtani deal, the Yamamoto deal, and kind of the next big contract that they sign, if
that
possible. You know, so my guess is that it's going to be like a relatively quiet offseason. Probably their biggest order of business will be to get, you know, because I think Andrew Friedman's contract is up now, or will be at the end of the year.
And so Dave Roberts, right? Don't they have to figure out what?
Then Roberts will be going into his walk year. So, you know, I think both of those guys are in line for, you know, big extensions, and that'll probably more or less be the thing. I could see, I guess, you know, probably, you know, some on the minor league side. I do think that the injuries, again, to the pitching has been a concern. So I could see them doing something maybe with, you know, some of that stuff, right? Their player development side on the pitching side, maybe, you know, kind of, you know, look to, you know, maybe bring in some new people there.
Right.
But I don't think it's going to be as big a thing. I think more or less the team we see now, it's going to more or less be kind of the team next year.
What was the take us there into the moment that you wrote about at the Los Angeles Times and Shohei Ohtani saying nine more? How did this come up?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, he just kind of snuck up to Friedman he loves the champagne stuff. You know, it's funny because he's really just kind of, and again, I can't really say I know him. Okay,
more than anybody, though, let's be clear, you more than anybody have really spent a lot of time to get to know him, going to his hometown, writing some of the great, I mean, if people have a chance to look back on stories you've written about him for the LA Times, even when he was with the Angels, just great, great stuff. And you've made the effort to go to his hometown, to get to know people and to spend time, if not with him, with people who do spend time with him.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I don't, I'll say this about him is that I've never found him to not be what he says and what people around him say he is, which is just, he just kind of loves playing baseball, you know? And he's just kind of this like big kid.
And he seems to really like the, you know, the spraying of the champagne and stuff. You know, I couldn't, just because of the deadline situation, I didn't really have time to work this in. But, you know, it's interesting because in Japan, what they'll do is they don't, right, because you can't dirty, you know, you've seen them, right? They're, mm-hmm. Their dugouts are like immaculate, right?
Right.
Okay. So they treat their clubhouses with the same reverence. So okay. They do not want beer soaking the carpet or anything. So what the teams do after they win, they'll go back to the team hotel, find like an underground parking lot, and do the beer stuff there.
Oh, and interesting.
So this is a couple hours after the game.
Yeah.
So this
yeah.
is like relative to Japan, this is like nuts, right? And I did ask Otani after the game, like, hey, you did it in Japan, right? The last time he celebrated that when he won a championship with the Nippon Ham Fighters, right? They did their little stuff, and there's no champagne over there. It's just beer, right? They pour beer on each other.
Yeah,
they did that, right? And it's of course it's a sponsor, you know, it's a Sapporo beer.
Sure.
And they did this like in an underground parking lot in Hiroshima. So I asked him like, hey, which do you prefer? You know, you've done it both ways now. And he's like, well, both have their own. You know, he kind of diplomatically said, but he made it clear he enjoys this a lot more.
That's great,
right? No, because he just go nuts. And so he was going around spraying stuff on everybody. He sees Friedman in the corner and kind of that, like, you know, that you see the smile of like an 8-year-old boy, right? And because Friedman was talking to like a circle of reporters, and Otani just kind of snuck behind and just jumped through and just got him in the face, man. And it was evidently telling him nine more. You know, I wasn't close enough to hear it. I saw it. But Friedman later said, yeah, he was saying, you know, he was hoping to do this 9 more times. And to me, that's just kind of the thing about him, right? Is that the, you know, somebody that knows him pretty well, and I kind of wrote about this, you know, after they clinched, was mentioned to me how he's mentally very different than most of the other players, right? That most of the players won't have the courage, so to speak, to have the ambition that he does, right?
Okay.
Because if you want to be the best of all time, that means everybody who tries that, except for one person, is going to fail, right? Only mm-hmm. one person can be that. By making goals like that, you're destined to fail, you know? And if you go back and look at, you know, again, and I'm sure it's somewhere up on the internet, Otani made like a list of goals, you know, when he was 17 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, by this point, he was expecting to have thrown multiple no-hitters, you know, won multiple WBCs, multiple World Series, multiple Cy Youngs. And if you kind of look at it in a way, like, he's fallen short of basically everything, right? Now, he didn't imagine he would be a two-way player at that point, right? Mm-hmm. But I think his strength is he's not afraid to, like, dream, you know? And so when he says 9 more, I actually believe that, like, he really thinks that, you know? Mm-hmm. Because you have to kind of remember, too, you know, I think our concept of sports and of winning, I think so much, if you think about just how much Michael Jordan redefined that for us, right, is that, you know, because I grew up watching Magic Johnson, right? You know, the John, right? So it's either, right, I think most people are either Magic fans or Bird fans, and whichever you were, both guys were just tremendous. But I think it kind of, my understanding kind of at the time was like, well, no matter how good you are, you can't win every year. That's impossible. Losing is part of the thing.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, Michael Jordan comes and it's like, wait a second, you can win every year, you know, basically, right? I mean, he played those 6 years, and he's like, he won every single time.
Yeah.
And it really kind of changed the way we view sports and the way we judge athletes, right? And,
great point.
And that's what, like, LeBron James is having to kind of compete against, right? And which is why I think we kind of feel like, well, LeBron doesn't win every year, so he can't be as good as Jordan, you know? It might not be fair, you know? And I think that that's what, like, you know, again, and I think it's hard to, you know, overstate just how much comic books are part of Japanese culture.
Right. Yeah. Like, he's a huge superhero fan, right? Yeah.
Adults read comic books. And here's the thing, man.
Adults read comic books here, man. I can show. I read a lot of. I read a comic book today. All right, adults read comic books here.
Okay, but it's like
issue of Amazing Spider-Man yesterday, fresh off the rack. All
right. But it's a very wide, right? It's more, you know, everybody reads comic books, right?
Yeah,
everybody does, and it's like a, you know, and the thing is, if you can imagine it, by the way, like, it exists. You know, I recently saw a drama on Netflix. It was based off a comic book, and it's about
this small company of like four people that's putting together a dictionary. Comic, right? So like, I'm just saying, it's like any kind of subgenre that you can imagine, it exists.
Right.
And so, you know, there are sports comics, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest ones that like kind of became like a global phenomenon, it's a soccer comic book that was very popular like in the 80s, right? Messi, right? It got mm-hmm. translated into every language. Messi read it, right? Like Alessandro Tiopero said that he, you know, started playing soccer because of that comic, right? Because the televised version, you know, got dubbed into like every language. But anyway, the protagonist of that thing never loses. He never loses. He wins every time, right? He finds a way to. Yeah. By the way, Julio Rios has a tattoo of that guy on his leg.
Oh, really?
Of his, wow. That character on his leg, right?
Wow. All right.
And so, I mean, it's that. Yeah. I mean, my guess is that right now there's a statue of one soccer player in Japan. Mm-hmm. And it's that main character.
It's the fictional character.
It's a fictional character. It's not even real, right?
Yeah.
But again, this is a character that kind of penetrated their society, right? And so again, it made this idea that you can win all the time. That exists in the air, right? And I've always said, again, Ohtani had to come from Japan in that, you know, okay, sure, there's nobody that's, right, hit and pitched at the same time in modern baseball.
Yeah.
There wasn't a comic book. In a comic book that Ohtani read. Right.
Right.
By the way, that main character signed all the MLB teams are fictionalized, but he does go to play for the team in Anaheim. By the way, you know.
Interesting. And so, wow.
But that idea existed, right? That idea of a guy who hits and pitches at the same time, maybe not in real life, but that idea exists. And so, you know, I think when Ohtani says like, "I want to do this nine more times." Yeah, like, you know, I actually think he really means it. You know, people, you know, Andrew was kind of joking, like, oh, you know, like he thinks it's easy, whatever. I would bet you anything that right now in Ohtani's mind, he thinks, I'm going to be the first guy, became the first guy to pitch and hit. Well, I'm going to be the first guy to win 10 championships in a row. Like, I would, because I really think his ambition is to be kind of that be all end all, right? He wants to be, again, the name of that fictional soccer player, Ozora Tsubasa, right? It's his impact. It's hard to, again, like, it's funny, as a little aside here, I think it was like in 06 or something, one of the World Cups, Japan couldn't score at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that main character, by the way, that fictional soccer player, was a number 10, which, if people don't know, it's kind of, you're a withdrawn forward, kind of a attacking midfielder.
Right.
And a columnist in Japan ripped the author of that comic book, saying that it's his fault that Japan doesn't have a pure goal scorer.
Oh, right? Fascinating.
Because if you look at like Japan, now I think this has more to do with like body types and stuff, frankly. But if you look at like Japan, they do produce like an abnormal amount of number 10s. If you look at like the number of players they've exported, you know, to Europe, mm-hmm. they send a lot of attacking midfielders, right? Who mm-hmm. all kind of fit the mold of that character, right? So again, I can't overstate like how big, right? But we think of Michael Jordan, probably this fictional character is that to kids in Japan. And, you know, again, Ohtani would have had exposure to this. This idea that you can win all the time is in the air over there.
Wow. All right. Well, someone we enjoy talking to, Stan Kasten, who's president there of the Dodgers, we both have had very entertaining conversations with him through the years, going back, I guess now 20 years for me and probably just as long for you. He talked about wanting to look back at this being a golden age of Dodgers. And he brought all this up, like, you know, that this is part of a championship era. You got Ohtani talking about 9 in a row. All of this comes just weeks after they were on the brink against the Padres. So let's close with this then. What's the biggest threat to the Dodgers? What stops this? What is the biggest threat to the Dodgers, either in the National League or in Major League Baseball? Or maybe it's internal.
It's just kind of the appetite to spend, right? I think if they keep spending, there's no reason they can't stay ahead. Just because, again, I think around the game, there's like an aversion to spending, right? And I don't think it's a coincidence, by the way, that, you know, the National League West right now has become as competitive as it is, that teams that have traditionally not spent, like the Padres, you know, the Diamondbacks are making investments they probably wouldn't have made 5 years ago, even 10 years ago. Look, I'll even throw the Giants in there, right? Even though they haven't had any success, they're willing to spend, right?
They're willing to spend.
you know, again, in this climate where I think, you know, owners, right, the owners have like kind of collectively convinced the fans that spending money isn't smart, that spending money is like not cool, you know, that gives the Dodgers like a huge edge right now, you know. And I think, and here's the thing, though, I do think that there is going to be kind of pressure in the city because, you know, they don't get the Dodgers aren't being compared to other Dodgers. Most people, you know, don't, right?
Interesting.
None of us. Well, because nobody's like old enough to remember Koufax, right? People, I'm guessing, look, I'm looking at a bunch of right, fans coming in right now. A lot of young people here. They don't remember Kurt Gibson, right?
Yeah.
What these Dodgers are being compared to are the Lakers of the Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal Lakers, who won three championships in a row. And, you know, if you kind of look from the outside, probably, right? I'm guessing people in other parts of the country, I was kind of explain this is that, you know, right, we every time the Dodgers get knocked out of the playoffs, even if they can win 100 games, whatever, they get knocked out, you know, people like me at Plasky wind up calling them losers and stuff. is because there is this expectation in the city that you're supposed to win all the time, right? That winning, yeah, you can basically guarantee wins. And that was taught to this city by Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant, right? Where it felt like, okay, you just roll the ball out there and you win. Even though this is a completely different sport, right? I 100% acknowledge that, right? That the, you know, basketball, usually the best team wins. American football, usually the best team wins, or the team that plays the best at least wins. Baseball, we know that doesn't happen, right? Things can just happen to a team. You have a bad couple of days. Next thing you know, you're out of it. But that's the reality that the Dodgers face. That's the history that they're up against. And you know what? If they get knocked out early next year, no one's going to give them a pass. Well, they won last year, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, sure, it might save some jobs, you know, might save people from getting fired, but the public is not going to accept that. That's kind of the expectation here. And I think that, you know, and frankly, I think that it's the franchise's acceptance of that that has made this team what it is this year, you know?
That's awesome.
You know, I think that, you know, after having two bad Octobers, I think Mookie Betts kind of looked at himself and was like, you know what, I can't run from this, right? You need to just, this is what it is. You need to embrace it. You need to face it head on. And that's the way the roster, I feel that the players really kind of, you know, stepped up to that challenge. And my guess is that, you know, and again, attitudes can be contagious, right? I do think, you know, we always talk about kind of top down, right? It kind of starts with the owner and then it trickles down. I also think the opposite can happen too, where the attitude of the players can kind of affect, you know, upper management, which then affects like ownership, right? Because now, you know, you always kind of hear, right, like at a trade deadline or at a, you know, free agency where the front office will say, well, we felt we owed it to these players to go out and get this guy, give them a chance, right? Well, after you see this, I think it's going to be really hard for them to kind of like rein in their spending. After Ohtani basically said, hey, you know what, don't pay me at all, you know, go out and spend it on other players. Once you kind of have that example set by the players, I think it's also going to be really hard, you know, from management to kind of back off that spending. So I think, you know, again, even though I kind of mentioned that they could have, you know, these contracts all kind of running in together, my guess is that the profits will be at such a point where, you know, because again, everybody's wearing like a brand new jersey right now that I'm looking around, right?
They'll just paper over it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, these are expensive. Yeah, so they can just keep out spending. You know, my guess is that this will continue probably a little bit longer than other teams might like.
That city pressure, that city brand, that city identity that you describe what it is here in St. Louis is that the Cardinals have the most World Series championships in the National League. And to give a little bit of history as we close this here, the first National League team to win two World Series was the Cubs. But in 1944, the Cardinals won their fifth World Series championship. That put them over the Giants, who had been the leader at that point in time. And the Cardinals have had the lead in the National League for 80 years since. They've been the team with the most. Obviously, the Yankees were the first to have the 6, 8, 9, 10, 11, all up to 27. The Cardinals with 11, they've had the most World Series championships in the National League since 1944. The Dodgers just won their 8th. That ties the Giants. And Dylan, man, that three gap has probably never felt closer.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be, you know what, like, I don't know about you, I really enjoyed those Dodger Cardinals clashes in 13 and 14.
Yeah, right? They're great.
That's like a great, you know, it's kind of
right? And
especially between the two beat writers.
Yeah, you know, and look, and we're not, you know, we're not above, at least I'm not above fanning the flames, you know, it's flyover country against the coastal elites, right?
Right.
You know, and yeah. I thought the fans kind of bought into it. The players, there was like legitimate animosity, I think, on some part, right? I mean, it got heated at some point. I still think about Adrian Gonzalez and the Mickey Mouse years.
Yeah.
You know, which was, right, and that stuff's great. And
it's classic.
So, yeah, I really hope, you know, again, you know, the hopefully the Cardinals kind of respond to what the Dodgers have just done here and kind of get themselves back on track, because these rivalries are great for baseball. You know, you don't want it to just be like one team winning every year. You know, and I think it's going to be, you know, right now, obviously Dodgers, Padres is kind of this thing. You know, and I think Dodgers, Cardinals to me is like one of the, you know, in my years here, it's been one of the great rivalries that I've covered.
That is Dylan Hernandez, sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and also before that, a longtime baseball writer. Dylan, thank you so much for taking all this time. You're getting ready to cover the parade there at Dodger Stadium, as we heard the parade of your fans walking through. It was very subtle how you signed autographs while also doing this podcast. Much appreciated. So, but you're going to take me up on, you're going to, I come out to LA a little bit more often than I expected now with my kid out there in college, but you're going to come to St. Louis because I owe you a meal. Well, not owe you, but I promised you a meal. And apparently now we also need to go to a comic book store, right?
We
so
do.
You're going to come visit. You're going to come visit. I'm going to show you like the great food of St. Louis. You know, we'll actually have like, we can have great pizza in my neighborhood. We can walk to a comic book store. No traffic. We'll walk there.
That'd be great.
Okay,
and,
all right.
You know what? And I will also, when let me know when you're down here next time. I got a couple taco spots that I can show you around SC.
All right, sounds good. I look forward to it. All right, I'll be out there later this month, actually. So I'll all look right. forward to it. Yeah, it'll be great. All right, thank you very much, Dylan. You can find all of his work at latimes.com. Tons of great coverage there, and I mean it. Just like dig in to all the stories that he has written through the years about Shohei Ohtani. Some of the most remarkable, just writing, in-depth reporting. He went above and beyond to go to Japan to get those stories. And it's great that the paper also invested that time and invested in you to tell those stories. You can find the best podcast in baseball wherever you get your podcast. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. For Dylan Hernandez of the Los Angeles Times, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon. Thanks so much, Dylan. Thank you, man. I know you got a lot to write. Thank you.
No, and thank you.
Hey, where do I tell my kid to look for you in the parade?
Oh, I'm at the I'm actually at the stadium.
No, so no, be, yeah, you're not getting a float. All right.
Yeah, I'm not getting a float. Yeah.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it, up to $2,000 in value, for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan, and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.